This episode is brought to you by The Syllabus, a nonprofit knowledge discovery service doing artisanal automation. How does that work? Well, they use technology to monitor thousands of sources, and each week, human curators, that is actual people, handpick the best of what's been published on the internet. When you sign up, you get to set up your feed. You'll pick from 6 languages and 60 topics like far-right populism or energy and extractivism, heterodox economics or AI and automation. Everything's there. Each Monday, you'll get a new batch of personalized recommendations. And it's not just podcasts. It's essays and books, academic articles and reports, and even videos. And I believe, dear friends, that American Prestige and even maybe Daniel Bessner himself has been featured on The Syllabus. So check out their website, the-syllabus.com. And there's a hyphen between the and syllabus. That was the dash I said. They offer 2-week free trials. And if you enter Prestige at checkout, you'll get 30% off your first year. And to remember, that's Prestige, P-R-E-S-T-I-G-E, and you enter that at checkout for 30% off your first year.
Hello, Nation listeners. This is Jake Aaron, producer of American Prestige. I just wanted to let everyone know that we will not be published on the Nation's feed over the next 2 weeks, but we will continue publishing over on our RSS feed, which you can find at AmericanPrestigePod.com. That said, after today, we are not putting out news roundups on our feed either until January 10th, 2025. We will instead have other exciting new episodes, including one with Ryan Grimm and Jan Philippin on a special drop site report, as well as another with Justin Boyd on the film Eyes Wide Shut. We will return to the Nation feed Tuesday, January 6th, and our news roundups will return Friday, January 10th. Hope you got that all straight. Thank you as always for listening, and have a great holiday season.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade Derek Davison, and we're very excited to bring you the news. But before we do, we just want to say happy holidays to everyone and to thank everyone for listening to us this last, 2.5 years, I think. Yeah, I think it's 2.5 years. And if you haven't yet, please consider subscribing and liking us and reviewing us. That actually helps the mighty algorithm. So thank you again. And we really do hope that everyone has happy holidays. All right, Derek, let's get into it. And let's start with Israel-Palestine and specifically these Gaza ceasefire talks.
This is like Groundhog Day. It's not Christmas. It's Groundhog Day. There is momentum, apparently, in the almighty Gaza ceasefire talks. Israeli officials, particularly the defense minister, Israel Katz, have been talking about progress that's been made in ceasefire negotiations. They have sent a delegation to Qatar, to Doha, to participate in the talks. The Biden administration has once again sent CIA Director Bill Burns to Doha to participate in the talks. So all the gang is getting back together, the same crowd of people that have failed consistently over the last 14 months to get a ceasefire done are back at it. What seems to have given to cause this rise in optimism is that Hamas has conceded a couple of points related specifically to Israel's continued military presence in Gaza along the two positions that the Israelis are insisting that they keep, one being the Egyptian border, the so-called Philadelphia corridor, and the so-called Netzarim corridor, which runs through the center of Gaza, separating north from south. And we'll actually talk about that again in a moment. But Hamas has apparently conceded to an Israeli military presence in those two areas for at least the initial part of a ceasefire deal. Now, there is still this nebulous idea of an indefinite ceasefire that would follow a short-term initial period with a limited exchange of hostages and prisoners for some term defined period, whether that's 60 days, 45 days, I don't know what's on the table at this point. And then negotiations would continue on a more enduring, indefinite ceasefire. The Israelis don't have any inclination toward actually participating in those talks or negotiating an indefinite ceasefire at this point. But they are willing to do the initial round. And this is probably where this whole thing's going to fall apart again. I don't mean to be too pessimistic here, because again, there is a lot of optimism. Things got to the point where I think Al Jazeera reported that Hamas had been exchanging names with the Israeli government indirectly. They're not meeting directly, of course, but exchanging names of people who would be exchanged, Palestinians being held by Israel, hostages being held in Gaza who would be released under the at least initial, again, phase of a deal. There was at one point a rumor that Benjamin Netanyahu was going to go to Cairo to put his signature on a deal that turned out to be wrong. He was in southern Syria celebrating his latest conquest. We'll talk about that as well. But there does seem to be a fair amount of, I hesitate to say genuine, but meaningful, in the at least in the reporting, optimism about the possibility of a deal. So I don't mean to bring anybody down here when I say that it's probably going to fall apart over the same thing or one of the major issues that's quashed every other attempt at this, which is that there's no good faith negotiation on the Israeli side about actually ending the massacre in Gaza. What they want is a, 60 day, as I said, window, maybe 60 days, a limited exchange of Palestinians and people being held in Gaza, and then to return to the fighting until they get the whatever vaunted military victory they think they're going to win over Hamas. Hamas's position is certainly weaker than it was the last time we went through this process, and the last several times it's been consistently getting weaker and weaker. Not only has it lost a number of senior personnel, there are reports that public sentiment in Gaza, as you might expect, is not terribly high as far as Hamas is concerned. People are suffering through the consequences of the what could be argued are the consequences of the October 7th attacks, and some of them seem to be taking it out on Hamas. That's not to say everybody, but there does seem to be some at least limited souring of opinion in some of the reporting I've seen. They're not in a great position to negotiate, but they are still insisting that if they do a limited first phase deal, they want a negotiated settlement on a indefinite ceasefire at the end of it. And I just don't think, I mean, the Israelis can say they're willing to talk about it, but I don't think they have any intention of actually agreeing to one. And that's probably going to be the thing that reemerges again at some point and breaks things up. But we'll see. Again, I don't want to be too overly pessimistic, but I don't see a bridging of that gap yet, which is the biggest probably gap that remains in the talks.
Come on, Derek, we need more sunshine on this podcast. Speaking of things to be pessimistic about, let's talk about these two new reports on Israeli conduct in the war.
So there's one report from Air Wars that was released, I believe, late last week that basically looked at the Israeli military's conduct in October of 2023. So for essentially the month after the October 7th attacks, just that month, and things certainly got worse as time went on. But they looked at just this initial month and said, I'm just going to quote one of the paragraphs here of the, introduction summary of the report. It says that the harm to civilians from the first month of the Israeli campaign in Gaza is incomparable with any 21st century air campaign. It is by far the most intense, destructive, and fatal conflict for civilians that Air Wars has ever documented. I guess this comes as no surprise to people who've been watching the slaughter of Palestinians over the last 14 months. But it is still putting it into stark terms like this. And Air Wars has covered pretty much the entire war on terror. So they've covered a lot that they can compare this to. And for them to say that this is the worst thing they've seen in their entire run, their entire operation, is pretty horrifying. Even if you've been bathed in this and inured to it somewhat, I think it's pretty awful to read that. The report goes on, and people, maybe we can put a link in the show description for people to read it, but it goes on in detail about just the extent of the violence, and again, in that just that first month, not even month, And it's really shocking to read.
Thank you, Derek.
There is a second report. Sorry, Danny. There's a second report.
Go for it.
From Haaretz that was just released this week, first in Hebrew, I think, and then in English, about the Israeli conduct around, I said we would get back to talking about the Netzarim corridor, which is this bisecting avenue that the IDF has carved for itself in across central Gaza, separating north from south. And this also is illuminating and shocking, and at the same time, not shocking if you've been, I guess, paying attention, but still to see it put out like this. Essentially, what the report goes into is the IDF's operating procedure around Netzarim, and it is just kill everybody who enters this corridor, any Palestinian who crosses the imaginary, invisible line that nobody can see, that's not demarcated anywhere, around this corridor that the IDF has carved out for itself. If they, you know, take one step into the wrong area, they are gunned down and left there. Their bodies are left there to be, eaten by dogs or other carrion animals, or to rot. It's built up at this point to where there is now, I guess, a discernible line of dead bodies that exists around this corridor that's supposed to warn people away from crossing into the wrong place. But it's indicative, I think, of the way this entire campaign has been conducted, with a shoot first, ask questions never mentality, with civilians treated as combatants indistinguishably, which is funny because that's the complaint that the Israeli government and Western governments make about the casualty figures that you get out of Gaza, is that they don't distinguish between combatants and civilians. Well, it turns out the IDF doesn't distinguish between combatants and civilians a lot of the time. And when they offer their figures as to the number of combatants that they've killed, they inevitably are including people who just got shot on sight for being in the wrong place like this. So I think if anybody's casualty figures should be called into question, it's the ones that you're getting from the Israeli government. There was another report in Haaretz that I haven't had time to really look at that was published on Thursday, basically saying, contributing to this and saying that the IDF has not changed its targeting information over the course of the Gaza campaign. What that means is basically if they identify a building as being used by, let's say, Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad or some other militant group, and they bomb it to kill those militants, that building is then marked as a militant hideout. And so later on, if it's still part of the structure, still standing, offering some shelter to somebody, if a group of civilians wanders into the structure, not knowing that it's been designated this way, but wanders into the structure to try and get some shelter, they are liable to be attacked again by the IDF, because the building itself has been marked as a lair of evildoers. So that just, again, I think highlights the extent to which there is no distinguishing, as far as the Israelis are concerned, between civilian and combatant here. They're just killing whoever they can justify killing.
Speaking of people justifying killings, let's talk about Syria, and let's talk about these reprisals.
This is a report in the Washington Post this week, and I want to put it in context. Everything that we continue to hear from Damascus, from the new ruling authorities, whatever you want to call them at this point, in Syria, is, you know, a good liberal, you know, suited for Western audience talk about Syria is a pluralistic country and the rights of all minorities, religious and ethnic, will be respected. And there's not going to be any effort to, carry out sectarian violence or to force anybody to convert or any of these types of things. The leader of Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, Ahmed al-Shara, who now fashions himself the de facto leader, he is the de facto leader of Syria, even talked this week about disbanding the coalition of militant groups that supported the takeover of Damascus and the ouster of former leader Bashar al-Assad, and turning those fighters, converting those fighters, training them basically to serve in a cohesive national military, which is also the kind of thing that you would try to demonstrate to a Western audience, that we're not just a gang of extremist groups or, you know, partially extremist groups. But this is a, you know, trained and disciplined fighting force, national military, that's not going around killing people willy-nilly. Well, so that's where this Washington Post report comes in. There have been several anecdotal reports, and the Post, I think, confirms that at least some of these have been accurate, of fighters from various groups, not necessarily Hayat Tahrir al-Sham, although there may be some HTS fighters participating in this, going after these take two forms, really. They're going after either people who are identified as having been connected with the Assad government, whether they were serving in the army or the security forces some other way, or some other type of official in the government under Assad, and targeting them and attacking, you know, villages or houses, even, you know, at the individual level, to go after these people. But the second type is the sectarian revenge attack. And these particularly target Alawite communities, because the Assads are Alawite. Their base of power was always identified with the Alawite community, a large portion of which, very large from what I can tell, is actually pretty pleased to see Bashar al-Assad go, and is not, you know, putting up a fight or even complaining about his departure. But they are now vulnerable to these sorts of attacks, and nothing in the Post story indicates this is, you know, a systematic policy or an approach that HTS is taking at an official level, but it reflects what we can say at this point is it's, you know, more these isolated factions within the rebel or insurgent, former insurgent groups who are carrying out these kinds of attacks. And the Post characterizes it as a challenge for Shara and HTS to try and corral these groups and prevent these sorts of attacks. I would view it more as a worrying sign of what may be to come. I think, you know, again, I've said this before, I think HTS, Shara, these officials who are now in charge of Syria de facto, are performing for the West when they say a lot of these things, and we can't be sure whether they actually mean it, or if in a year or two, when there are not so many eyeballs on Syria, you're going to start to see repression on a much bigger, more systemic scale against these minority groups. I think only time will tell, and by the time we find out, it will probably be too late. But this is not a good sign that these things are happening.
Well, at least the United States is going to come in and help, right? So let's talk about
the
U.S.
Yeah.
Let's talk about the United States failing to broker a ceasefire between Turkey and the Syrian Democratic Forces.
Right now, yeah, the biggest thing, I mean, we've seen, you know, Antony Blinken between Blue's Licks saying that the U.S. has had some contact with HTS, despite the fact that HTS is a designated terrorist organization as far as the U.S. is concerned, that it has had some contact. There's been a little bit of talk about sanctions relief. I think there's a wait and see attitude about that, and taking it, you know, waiting to see how these new authorities kind of manage the transition process, although there are certainly immediate needs in terms of humanitarian relief, in terms of just basic, you know, kind of living situations. So, you know, we'll have to wait and see how that plays out. But right now, the biggest concern I think the U.S. has is the conflict that is continuing in the northeastern part of Syria between the Syrian Democratic Forces, the U.S. client led by the Kurdish YPG militia, and Turkey, basically, with its Syrian National Army proxies. They fought over the town of Manbij early on, shortly after the rebel offensive or insurgent offensive began. And then that has that resulted in a supposed ceasefire agreement that the U.S. brokered to give the SDF time to withdraw from Manbij to cross the Euphrates River. Manbij is on the western side of the Euphrates. The idea was that the SDF would cross over to the eastern side and then would be left alone. The Turkey, the SNA, would that would be the end of it. Well, Turkey has repeatedly insisted that there is no deal. There's never been a ceasefire. They don't know what anybody's talking about when they talk about this ceasefire. The U.S. and the SDF keep talking about a ceasefire, but the Turks say, you know, there's nothing like that. And they fully intend to continue pursuing the Syrian Democratic Forces until basically it disarms itself, until it purges the YPG from its ranks, which, you know, the YPG, the Turks identify the YPG as essentially just a relabeling of the Kurdistan Workers Party, which they've outlawed as a terrorist group. And so they're insisting that the SDF kind of lay down and take it. The battle is now around the city of Kobani, or the town of Kobani, which is very important to both sides. It is symbolically important to the Kurds, the YPG, because the YPG lost a number of fighters defending Kobani from Islamic State, which had, we don't like to talk about this, but had some de facto Turkish help way back in the early, you know, early months of the civil war in Syria. So it's a place that has great significance to them, and they are not, doesn't sound like they're prepared to give it up without an agreement or a fight. They've offered, I think, to demilitarize Kobani and the area around it, but they're not willing to just retreat from it without some kind of agreement with the Turks. The Turks have rejected that. They've been building up forces along the border. The Syrian National Army, these factions have been kind of massing forces around Kobani. There is a site in Kobani that is symbolically important for the Turks. It's the tomb of Suleiman Shah, who's the grandfather of the founder of the Ottoman Empire, Osman the First. So they would like to, they feel some connection with the area because of that. I believe at one point his bones were moved from the tomb because of his remains were moved from the tomb because of the Kurdish presence, and the Turks would like to put them back. And to, you know, drive the Kurds. Again, it's not really so much about this one site. It's more about defeating the SDF and purging the YPG from it. But anyway, the U.S. is still talking about the ceasefire. They said earlier this week that it had been extended at least through like Friday or the weekend, only to have the Turks once again say, what ceasefire? There is no ceasefire. So I really don't know what's happening here, but it doesn't seem like whatever the U.S. thinks it's doing is actually taking.
Thanks, Eric. What about Israel, which has started to occupy southern Syria?
The Israeli military moved into the essentially Syrian Golan. I mean, the entire Golan is Syrian. It's occupied territory. But the Israelis have occupied part of the Golan since 1967. They've occupied essentially the rest of the Golan, including Mount Hermon, which is the highest point in the region, the highest point in Syria, strategically valuable for that reason. There are reports of basically Israeli forces pushing beyond the buffer zone that was established in 1974 to end Syria's involvement in the Yom Kippur War that was supposed to protect Israel's occupation of the 1967 parts of the Golan. Now they've occupied the entire buffer zone and pushed beyond that. In some cases, they've seized a dam along the Jordanian border. They've crossed into Dera province, which is next door to Quneitra province, where a lot of this stuff is happening. They have pushed north along the Lebanese-Syrian border. So they're occupying a swath of territory that they did not control previously. And of course, fortunately, there's no precedence for this kind of thing turning into a full long-term occupation settlement. What happened this week on Tuesday, Benjamin Netanyahu, as I said, this was the day he was allegedly, there were these rumors that he was going to Cairo to finish a ceasefire deal. Well, actually he turned up in Syria on Mount Hermon, where he had a performative security briefing, basically announcing that this is Israeli territory now, tough luck. And has he and Katz, the defense minister, have been telling Israeli forces to prepare for an extended occupation, go figure, of this region. Netanyahu is now talking about staying at least through the end of 2025. And I don't know, he may mean 2025 on like the Mayan long calendar or something, which would put us, you know, 10,000 years in the future, for all I know. But he is, certainly saying at least through the end of next year on our regular calendar, and I would assume beyond. He's talked about holding on to Mount Hermon and these high points until another arrangement can be found that meets Israel's security needs. And the great thing about that is Israel's security needs can be whatever you want them to be at any particular time. So I'm fully expecting to see settlers kind of cropping into this area, popping up in this area at some point, but we'll see.
We will see, but it seems like you are correct. I would be shocked if that didn't happen. All right, let's talk about Libya, which we haven't spoken about in a while, but it appears that Russia might be moving military assets from Ukraine to Libya. So, Derek, why is that?
Well, it's because they're not welcome in Syria anymore. I mean, you know, we don't know this for a fact. The discussion from, or the rhetoric around this from both the authorities in Syria and the Russian government has been, you know, we're going to talk about this. We're not making any rash decisions. Russia is saying, you know, we're not withdrawing. You know, we're not leaving Syria. We want to negotiate with the new authorities. But of course, the new authorities have bigger fish to fry right now, as it were. So it's not a priority. But in the meantime, there's a lot of satellite imagery and a lot of other evidence that seems to suggest that the Russians have been moving a lot of their military assets out of Syria. And much of that materiel is going apparently to Libya. Libya makes sense for a number of reasons. It's sort of, you know, it's not the same region, but it's sort of the same general vicinity in the Eastern Mediterranean. It allows Russia to maintain a footprint, a naval footprint and aerial footprint in the Mediterranean area. So it fills some of the purposes that its bases in northwestern Syria serve. Russia also has a close relationship with the warlord Khalifa Haftar, who controls eastern Libya. And so, you know, he's happy to bring these Russian forces in. And I think the issue that one has to look at, I mean, obviously the attention with Western governments and Western media outlets is going to be on, oh my God, the Russians are, you know, expanding their empire or whatever it is we're calling it these days into Libya. But I think the bigger concern for me would be what's going to happen to Libya here, because there is a possibility that a guy like Haftar or his sons, he's got several of them. He's a, you know, older guy, has had cancer, I believe. So not in the greatest of health, but he does have a number of sons.
They should appoint him to a leadership position like we do in the United States.
In the Democratic Party,
yes. You actually get promoted when you have cancer.
Yeah. But so, you know, I mean, I think, you know, even if he himself is not eyeing this, he's got some ambitious sons who might be eyeing it. A few years ago, Haftar tried to conquer Tripoli and eliminate the government in Western Libya. He failed because that government got support primarily from Turkey, primarily through the use of drones, was able to drive back Haftar's army and return Libya to this very tenuous east-west divide that it's been under pretty much since, you know, not long after the fall and killing of Muammar Gaddafi. But there is a possibility, if Russia is going to move heavy amounts of material, military assets into Libya, that a guy like Haftar could become emboldened to think, hey, I've got, you know, all this Russian support now at my fingertips. What's to stop me from trying to conquer Tripoli again? Or at the very least to say, screw you to any continuing efforts at political settlement to that east-west divide, and just sort of do my own thing and rely on Russian support to get me there. So I think there is a potentially destabilizing element of this for Libya that we'll have to, you know, keep an eye on.
Destabilizing in Libya? Come on, Derek. I don't believe that.
Well, it's hard to imagine. Yes, I know.
Let's move on to Sudan, where there's been more RSF attacks in Al-Fashir.
Yes. I mean, I wanted to mention this mostly because we're going to be off for a couple of weeks and people should be aware that this is still going on. The city of Al-Fashir, the capital of North Darfur state in Sudan, is still under siege by the Rapid Support Forces. They are still shelling, starving, you know, all the horrifying things that we've been talking about for months now. All of that is still going on. This week, they seem to have taken a new interest in the Saudi hospital in Al-Fashir, which is the only one in the city that is still functioning, even at a minimal level, to be able to treat the people, the casualties that are caused by these RSF attacks. And so they've shelled it a couple of times. They've used drones to strike it on at least one occasion. It's not a huge new development or anything. It is a continuation of what's been going on there consistently for quite some time now. But I did feel we should mention it.
And in shocking news, Yoon in South Korea has been impeached. I didn't expect this, Derek. So tell me what's been going on.
Yoon Suk-yeol, the president of South Korea, for the second time was the charm, basically. The South Korean parliament got together on Saturday, 1 week after they tried the first time and failed because Yoon's People Power Party walked out of the chamber and prevented them from getting to the 200 votes they needed to impeach him. But they tried a second time. And were successful. 12 members of the People Power Party joined the opposition. The party itself just hung around this time. They didn't walk out. And that made 204 votes, for removing Yoon from office, which is 4 more than was required. Yoon had given a speech on Thursday in which he basically told the People Power Party to get bent. The leader of the party had been telling people that Yoon had agreed to resign, that he didn't support impeachment, but he would resign at some point. And in the meantime, he was going to suspend himself from state business. And basically, Yoon gave a speech that said, none of that is true. I'm not leaving. I'm fighting. You can all bite me, effectively. That was enough, I think, that was sort of the final straw for the party, which was increasingly frustrated with him anyway, or had been frustrated basically since his attempted self-coup earlier this month. The party basically told its legislators to do as you wish, vote your conscience. And they did. Enough of them did to impeach him. The case has now been taken up by the South Korean Constitutional Court, as is required by law. It has up to 6 months to issue a final ruling on the legitimacy of the impeachment that will either remove Yoon from office, obviously, or keep him. Which would be fascinating if it decides that he should stay. I don't know how he's going to govern after any of this, but after all of this, but we'll see. If he is removed, that would trigger a snap election within, I think, 60 days. But in the meantime, the prime minister of South Korea, Han Duk-soo, assumes the powers of the presidency on an interim basis. So that is the situation in Seoul. Stable as always.
Stable as always. Let's move on to Russia, Ukraine. And let's start with this assassination of the Russian general.
On Tuesday, the Ukrainian intelligence agency, the SBU, took credit for this. It was a car bombing. Actually, I think they put the bombs in a scooter. But in Moscow, that killed Igor Kirillov, who was the commander of the Russian military's nuclear, biological, and chemical protection troops. He had been accused, and his unit had been accused, of using chemical weapons against Ukrainian soldiers. That's a charge, of course, the Russian government denies, unsurprisingly. But this is a big step up. I mean, the Ukrainians have undertaken these sorts of targeted attacks against Russian officials or prominent figures in the past, most of them on what would still be internationally recognized as Ukrainian territory, kind of local officials, governors, that type of thing. They have, on a couple of occasions, killed people in Russia. There was the case of Alexander Dugin's daughter. They were obviously targeting Dugin, who is Vladimir Putin's kind of guru or something. I don't really understand the relationship, but they were trying to kill him and killed his daughter instead. That was a while back. There have been a few others like that, but Kirillov, a senior general in the Russian military, this is a pretty big step up in that assassination program. So the Russians obviously say they're going to retaliate at some point. One could argue that the assassination itself was the retaliation for, everything that's happened. But, they still seem to have taken offense. So I would expect some sort of response, or what will most likely happen is they will just do something that they were planning to do to Ukraine anyway. And they will say this is, the retaliation for assassinating this general and call it a day.
Let's talk about Russian forces closing in on Pokrovsk.
This was, I mean, it's been happening for a while, but on earlier or late last week, I guess it was late last week, there were reports of these, you know, so-called war bloggers, people who are active on Russian, you know, the Telegram outlet, for example, who track, try to track very closely the movements that are going on in Ukraine. And they reported, some of these people reported late last week that the Russian military had advanced to within 1.5 kilometers of Pokrovsk. There's no particular reason to doubt this. I mean, they've been seizing villages around Pokrovsk, approaching it for months now. So, you know, it sounds like they're fairly close to entering the city, or at least the outskirts of the city at this point, which would be presumably the beginning of the takeover. Pokrovsk is one of the two main axes that the Russians have been advancing on for quite some time now. The other is Krahovia, which is a town to the south. Both of them have strategic significance. Pokrovsk is a logistical hub. It's been very important to the Ukrainian defensive line. It's also where Ukraine's one coking coal mine is. Coking coal is used in steel manufacturing, and the loss of that mine would you know, be a blow to the Ukrainian. It's already shut down, but losing it to the Russians would be a blow to Ukrainian industry. Krahovia also has some mineral deposits. I don't know the extent of it around it, but it's considered valuable for that reason. In addition to, you know, this is just territory that the Russians want. It's in, they're both in Donetsk Oblast, which the Russians claim to have annexed, and they want to make the legal claim a fact on the ground, as it were, by holding all that territory.
Zelensky is in Brussels. Why?
There is a meeting, or there are a series of meetings this week in Brussels of the of NATO European leaders basically coming to talk to Zelensky, I think mostly trying to get some ducks in a row before Donald Trump takes office in January in the U.S. Trump, of course, taking a very dim view of the Ukrainian war, or the Russian invasion and the Ukrainian resistance, and would like to settle things probably mostly on Russian terms at this point. But the main topic of conversation does seem to be the idea of peacekeepers. This would be an element of a ceasefire deal if, you know, brokered by Trump or whomever, that you would have a peacekeeping force deployed to eastern Ukraine to sit on the front lines and prevent any, or at least monitor for ceasefire violations. That peacekeeping force is not going to come from the U.S. Trump has made it very clear that while he wants an end to this war and wants it off his plate, he does not want to contribute peacekeepers. So it would have to come from Europe. And there's no, doesn't seem to be really much appetite among European governments to participate in something like this. But I think there's a recognition that it may be unavoidable if they don't want to see just a complete you know, pull out on the part of the U.S. from supporting Ukraine, which would potentially collapse the Ukrainian military and lead to a much worse outcome. So they may have no choice but to try something like this. Zelensky came to Brussels with the position that he's willing to accept peacekeepers, but he also wants a commitment for Ukraine's NATO membership, which he's, of course, not going to get. You know, it's been his demand, but there's no movement on the part of NATO to offer him such a commitment. What he may wind up getting is just a kind of vague commitment to peacekeepers, and that's it. We'll have to see. I don't know that peacekeepers are going to be any more palatable to the Russians than NATO membership is, frankly. Ukraine's NATO membership is, and that's a red line for them. So, you know, whether this could even be a part of a negotiated ceasefire that the Russians would agree to still, I think, remains to be seen.
And let's move on now to the new Cold War. And let's start with China and the United States extending their research agreements.
New Cold War. On Friday, the U.S. and Chinese governments agreed to renew the 1979 U.S.-China Science and Technology Cooperation Agreement for at least 5 more years. This is an agreement that was fairly uncontroversial in 1979. It basically facilitates joint research projects between the two countries. It is extremely controversial now, because of the new Cold War, because of concerns that any science or technology breakthroughs could be weaponized. And so the renewal comes with additional guardrails about the kinds of research that can be covered under it, and the detail, the amount of scrutiny that new projects under this agreement will be subjected to by the U.S. Congress and U.S. officials. You know, despite those guardrails, this was, of course, received by Republicans as an act of betrayal, trying to handcuff the incoming Trump administration on the part of the communist Biden administration.
Let's talk about this naval vessel docking in Cambodia.
This is such a minor thing, but it actually has some symbolic significance. The USS Savannah, which is a U.S. Navy littoral combat ship. We should actually do an episode about the littoral combat ship. That is one of the biggest military boondoggles of my lifetime. But anyway, it docked at the at a Cambodian port on Monday. This is the first time in 8 years that a U.S. naval vessel has put in to port in Cambodia. So that's why it has some symbolic significance. Danny, I don't know if you are aware of this, but relations between the U.S. and Cambodia are not all that great historically.
I wonder why.
I don't know. It must be, you know, they must just irrationally dislike the United States for some reason. But anyway, partly because of that, and partly, you know, things have been tense. That's part of the reason why there's been this 8 year, you know, pause in U.S. The U.S. Navy using Cambodian ports. But also there has been in recent years a particularly high new Cold War related level of concern on the part of the United States, because they're worried that the Cambodian government might give the Chinese military a naval base right in America's backyard in the Gulf of Thailand. I mean, that's you know, basically, you might as well just park it right next door to New York City at that point. So there's a lot of concern in Washington about this and how unfair it would be if China had a naval base in the Gulf of Thailand in Cambodia. But in recent months in particular, there's been some thawing in this relationship. Hun Manet, who is now the leader of Cambodia after taking over for his father, Hun Sen. Hun Manet is a West Point graduate, so that probably gives him some affinity for the U.S. Or, I mean, I guess you could go either way, but in his case, it seems to be affinity. And he does seem interested in improving relations with the United States. So, you know, we can see things like the Savannah's arrival as, again, a symbolic indication that things are trending up a little bit in the relationship.
Thanks, Derek. And I'm going to show people a little bit how the sausage is made. I've got my baby boy on my lap, and he literally called you Dada, and he barely calls me that. So I don't know if that's a good sign or not.
I think, you know, he just recognizes what's authority. Going on.
Yeah.
That's right. Authority. That's correct.
So let's conclude with Trump's foreign policy team, which, shock among shocks, is targeting China.
Yes. I mean, there's a piece in Tom Dispatch, which, you know, I would recommend if people, anybody who reads Tom Dispatch to take a look at this. But essentially, yeah, I mean, I don't want to go too far into this, but it highlights the extent to which the anti-war Donald Trump has stacked his incoming cabinet with people who are desperate to take on China, who view China as the only threat, really, to continued global dominance of the United States. You know, that's everybody from Secretary of State, incoming Secretary of State Marco Rubio, to incoming National Security Advisor Michael Waltz. But even beyond them, you know, while there are some, appear to be some, you know, sort of differences of opinion, maybe among some of the people Trump has appointed on issues related to the Middle East or related to even Russia, or other areas, the one thing that they all seem to agree on is that China is the big bad, and needs to be taken on. And that's going to lead to, you know, tense relations. It's going to lead to potentially the tariffs that Trump wants to impose, all the wonderful things that we have to look forward to as the new Cold War really ratchets up potentially under the next Trump 2.0 administration.
Thank you, Derek. Thank you again, everyone, for listening. We genuinely hope you have a great holiday season. We've got some cool, interesting. Darius calling you dad again. We've got some cool, interesting episodes coming out. We're even going to do a movie episode on a classic feel-good Christmas movie by Stanley Kubrick. And we will see you all again soon. And as always, keep on rocking in the free world.
Take it easy, Leo. Bye, everybody. Happy holidays.